Welcome to In-Depth, an in-depth look at the interesting, educational, and timely topics affecting you right here in South Central Iowa and beyond. The one to count on for today's local news coverage is KNIA and KRLS. Now with today's In-Depth, here's Dr. Bob Leonard.
Today is Thanksgiving Day. Today we go to the location of the first Thanksgiving. Let's go in depth with Kathleen Curtin, food historian at Plymouth Plantation, Plymouth, Massachusetts. Kathleen, you're a food historian.
Yes, I am, yep.
What a great job.
I know, isn't it? Well, I started out my career here as a role player, one of the characters that people met in the English Village, and that was 20 years ago, and just have become increasingly interested in the ways that food can be used to explore history and culture. And wrote a book a couple of years ago that's about the history of Thanksgiving, so it's sort of a very fun topic.
Well, I guess so, and you're right there where Thanksgiving all began, I understand.
That's right, here where that harvest celebration of 1621 began, absolutely.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about that first Thanksgiving?
Sure. I should start off by saying that the people who were involved wouldn't have considered it a Thanksgiving at all. For them, Thanksgiving was a day spent at church, and it had a lot more religious implications than it did food implications. So for the people who came on Mayflower, Thanksgiving really wasn't a feast day. What they had was more a harvest celebration. They would have considered that event to be a typical sort of end-of-the-season harvest event. There were 90 Wampanoag who came to join the 50 colonists who were left alive. And we know that they celebrated for at least 3 days. They feasted. They entertained each other by practicing their arms and bows and arrows. And there must have been a fair amount of diplomacy as well. And more than a little bit of awkwardness, too, if you think about it. The cultures were extremely different, and they didn't share a common language.
Well, there's enough possibility for confrontation and being uncomfortable at regular family Thanksgiving.
Absolutely. You must sort of think of it like the worst of a family wedding where you have the bride's family and the groom's family, but neither of them sharing a language, so pretty interesting.
Well, and I presume that they ate different things at that first Thanksgiving than we do now.
Very much so. There is one letter that documents the event. It wasn't a famous event in its own time, and it pretty much gets forgotten about until the middle of the 1800s when someone discovers it and calls it the first Thanksgiving. Up until that time, people didn't even think about it. But what we do know from that letter is that they had wildfowl, geese, and duck, and they had venison that were brought by the Wampanoag, and all the other details of the meal are what we fill in using the primary sources we have here and knowing what was available in the season of the year. So no turkey that we know of. Well, they may have had turkey. Turkeys were around in the area, and it was a three-day feast, but they're not documented by any means.
Not necessarily a turkey. So turkey isn't part of that early celebration. But how did it emerge as an important part of, or the centerpiece of ours?
Well, Thanksgiving, while it didn't start in 1621 Plymouth, it does start in New England. Our modern Thanksgiving does grow out of those Puritan ideas of Thanksgiving. The Puritans believed that you should give thanks to God for momentous occasions. And the first Thanksgiving they actually document here is in 1623 at the end of a drought. Later on in the 17th century, they start sort of combining this notion of an end-of-the-year harvest with a Thanksgiving day. And little by little, the food becomes increasingly more important in the holiday meal. So the church service becomes a little bit less important. It's time is shaved off of it. You're not spending the whole day at church anymore. You're spending half a day there instead and having a meal in the afternoon. And being New Englanders, turkeys are a beautiful bird. They're indigenous to the area. They're a lovely centerpiece. But people just didn't have turkey. They had other meats as well. If you're serving a family of upwards of 20 or more people, you need more meat than just the meat provided by one turkey. Those turkeys back then weren't the sort of turkeys we have nowadays either. They were turkeys that actually flew and were pretty lean, so you might have roast pork and a chicken pie on the table along with a lovely Thanksgiving turkey.
And no green bean casserole.
Now, that came later, though I have to admit, even though I love to cook, green bean casserole is one of the dishes I have to have on my Thanksgiving table.
So you don't do a traditional Thanksgiving at your house?
Well, I work at Plymouth Plantation, so I have not been home for Thanksgiving for 20 years now. We have Thanksgiving afterwards, and we do a traditional Thanksgiving in that we have lots of root vegetables. We have turkey, we have stuffing, we have carrots and turnips mashed together. We have mashed potatoes, which are very traditional as well. But we definitely have some modern 20th century type dishes, like the green bean casserole. My brother also makes a wonderful pumpkin cheesecake, too, so we've definitely taken on some 20th century airs in our meal.
How many meals does Plymouth Plantation serve on Thanksgiving?
Well, Thanksgiving week, we will serve turkey to approximately 5,000 people. On Thanksgiving Day alone, we'll serve 3,500 people their traditional Thanksgiving meal at a variety of dinners that take place in our visitor center. When people visit the museum, the meals take place at our visitor center, but when they walk on the site, it's not Thanksgiving Day. When they visit the pilgrims in the 1627 English village and meet our role players, they come to realize that our modern Thanksgiving is a modern American holiday. And in the year 1627, the third Thursday in November, the fourth Thursday in November, is just a regular day, regular work day.
I bet you get people from all over the world, too.
We really do. We have lots of visitors who come from Europe, lots of visitors who come from Asia as well. We're very well known internationally. A lot of people who are studying America, they completely bypass Jamestown and head right for the pilgrims. So it's an ironic thing because Jamestown predates the English colony by some 13 years, the pilgrim colony rather, but there's something about the pilgrims that just sort of appeals to people. I think it's that sense of families coming over and people coming over for to bring their religion and to celebrate their religion here.
Well, it seems that a lot of the original intent of, I guess, the 1800s Thanksgiving and the Pilgrims' Thanksgiving, where one was truly giving thanks, has been a little bit lost today.
I would say so. Certainly, you know, the church service was the most important thing in the 17th century, and the food was, you know, part of that, but not as important. And over time, the religious aspect has declined considerably. You know, the death knell for having church services on Thanksgiving happens when you start including football. Something's got to go. You can't do, you know, a feast and football and church. So really, at the turn of the 20th century, with the increase in football games and sports happening, the religious part of the holiday really falls by the wayside. And you end up with a holiday that has very religious roots. Thanksgiving, it has roots in the Puritan religion, the Protestant religion, really becoming our most favorite secular holiday. There's no sense of worship attached to it nowadays in most families, which is really interesting. And I think the pilgrims would be spitting in their graves if they knew that our Thanksgiving has become more about food and football. They would admire some parts of it. They certainly would like the fact we're celebrating the harvest and we're getting together with family, but I think the fact that it is so purely secular in most families would be a bothersome thing to them.
And for even those of us who like football, it's such a puzzle that it's so tied to the Detroit Lions.
Yeah, well, they were the first ones to do it, so they were the first ones to broadcast a game on radio. So, yeah, I know you sort of want to root for your own home team sometimes, but it is tied to that. I think it's the Lions and the Cowboys these days who play on Thanksgiving Day, and whoever they're opposing as well.
Well, so that was an interesting marketing ploy by them.
By the football teams, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, football, even before then, you had colleges playing football and high schools playing football, even before the professional team. So football, pretty early on, becomes a part of the holiday at the end of the 19th century. You know, sports of all sorts have always been part of the holiday as well. I should mention that, you know, sort of playing games and getting together with your family and having some sport is an important part of the holiday for most of the 1800s, too.
More in depth after this. I continued my conversation with Kathleen Curtin, food historian at Plymouth Plantation. It seems that perhaps much of America retreats to traditional gender roles with respect to the preparation of the meal, doesn't it?
I think in a fair amount of households, I think that you tend to see that. And the men watching football and the ladies preparing the dinner, it's kind of ironic when you think about it, but we do that. I hadn't really given that much thought.
Well, I remember my grandmother shooing me out of the kitchen for years.
Yeah, and you know, it could be just a sense of solidarity with women too. You know, they all want to get together and gossip, and it's a kind of a nice occasion. Most of the time you're cooking in solitude when you're preparing your family dinner, but on Thanksgiving, you know, all the women can gather in the kitchen and help prepare the food. So there's a little bit more of a esprit de corps from the folks in the family to put the meal out on the table.
Now, where did this cranberry thing come from?
Well, you know, cranberries are pretty early on. Cranberries are something that colonists knew about when they came here, because there are variations of a cranberry that do exist in England. And they certainly knew to put lots of sugar when they found tart berries. Probably in 1621, they didn't have enough sugar to make a cranberry sauce, to make it sweet. But by the 1640s, so 20 years after Mayflower arrived, we start seeing the first signs of cranberry sauce. They have enough sugar by then, and they start adding lots of sugar to cranberries, and they say that it's a good relish for meat. So they're already attaching this cranberry sauce, this tart sauce, to meat dishes. So I think that that is one of the dishes on the Thanksgiving table that they would strongly identify with and find very familiar.
Except for that coming in a can part.
Well, some people still make it from scratch. I have to admit, though, we tend to have both in our family. We have the whole cranberry sauce, or the cranberry relish, or cranberry chutney, whatever I'm making. But we still have the cranberry sauce that we open both ends of the can and push it out, and you have to slice it in perfect slices. So another part of our strange family tradition that harkened back to, you know, my grandmother's time, I suppose.
Well, that divides our family down the middle, too, whether you get the nice, fresh cranberry, orange, ginger, relish, whatever mix it is with nuts, or straight out of the can.
That's right. Well, you can have both, which is the nice thing. You know, the other thing that divides families is stuffing. I mean, there have been pitched battles over whose stuffing is going to be served. And in our family, we do a couple of stuffings most of the time. My mom is Italian, and so we have an Italian sausage stuffing, and then we also have a traditional cornbread stuffing.
Well, they both sound great. So
yeah.
I understand why you do both.
Yeah, definitely.
More in depth after this. I continued my conversation with Kathleen Curtin, food historian at Plymouth Plantation.
One of the things in my cookbook, one of the things I was looking at was ways that modern families today show a sense of who they are, whether that be the region they're from or their ethnic traditions on the Thanksgiving table. And it's very striking. It, in most families, there is one or two dishes on the table that tell a story of who they are, where they come from, choices they make in their stuffings or side dishes, just those sorts of preparation of the turkey even. There's a wonderful recipe I have in the cookbook that has a turkey that's a steamed turkey with a rice dressing in it that comes from a Chinese tradition. So, you know, there you have a culture that takes the traditional American food stuff that Thanksgiving and very much includes their cultural identity in it.
Can you tell us something of your favorite recipe for Thanksgiving?
Oh, boy. You know, I have a lot of recipes or dishes that I like to have on the table. I love to have celery stuffed with cream cheese. It's one of those dishes that I think is absolutely necessary on the Thanksgiving table, and that recipe couldn't be any simpler. As I mentioned, green bean casserole is one of those dishes that we always have. I'm very traditional in my pies, I have to say, and I wouldn't consider it Thanksgiving if there's not an apple pie and a pumpkin pie on the table. But I do remember my grandmother always had a mince pie as well, and that's what I consider the holy trinity of New England pies, to have a mince pie, an apple pie, and a pumpkin pie. But little by little, the mince pie has lost its popularity, I think, in most Thanksgiving tables, which is a shame, because it really is a great traditional pie. I think it's mostly gotten supplanted by chocolate. Americans love their chocolate, and that would be one untraditional aspect of Thanksgiving I see on the increase. Lots more chocolate being served. It doesn't really go with the other desserts often.
Yes, I miss those mince pies, too. They're pretty amazing, and mince itself used to mean something different than what we're thinking of, too, didn't it?
Very much so. I included several different mince pie recipes. The first mince pies were mostly meat with dried fruit and spice in them, and you know, that's what you see in the 16th and 17th centuries. So starting with beef and mincing it finely, including suet, dried spices and dried food and baking it up. In the 19th century, you get that. The meat decreases a little bit. You get more of the dried fruit, and you also add alcohol. And so you have a mince pie that you pour liquor into, and you keep in a crock on the in the pantry. But by the 20th century, the meat almost disappears, and you get vegetarian recipes, or you get mince pie that has just a small amount of suet in it. And they lose their richness then. They lose that wonderful mouthfeel you get from a proper mince pie.
Well, what other changes do you see in Thanksgiving these days?
You know, there has been a lot of changes as a result of marketing. As I mentioned, Thanksgiving used to include a lot of different types of meat. Turkey was always on the table, but lots of other things, too. And I think the 20th century has definitely been one of the trends has been the rise of the turkey and also changes in the way that turkeys are bred. You know, that turkey that used to go out and hunt in the 19th century wouldn't feed a large family, but nowadays there have been changes in the way they raise turkeys where you end up with these very tender, breast-heavy turkeys that really can't stand that, can feed a large family, 24-pound turkeys and such. I think the ability to have whatever you want in any season has changed Thanksgiving, too. For people who were celebrating Thanksgiving in the 19th century, they were pretty restricted to what grew in their area, but now that you have canning and processing of foods and frozen foods, you can basically have foods out of seasons or foods that aren't typical to your region, which makes it nice in some ways that, you know, people in California can have cranberries. But in other ways, I think, has meant that we're not really honoring what I think is part of the tradition of the holiday, which is eating from the local harvest. And I think that can be one of the nicer aspects of it.
Now, could you mention the name of your book and where we can find it?
Sure, you can get it in most bookstores, and if not, certainly on any of the online bookstores. The book is called Giving Thanks, Thanksgiving Recipes and History from Pilgrims to Pumpkin Pie. But just Giving Thanks alone will get you to the cookbook if you go on any of those websites.
Now, are there certain prayers that are appropriate for Thanksgiving, or people just devise their own?
There are, I think, some you know, simple Thanksgiving that people might have a tradition of in their family. In 1621, the people who celebrated that first harvest celebration would have deliberately chosen not to have prayers that they memorized by rote, but would have rather done an extemporaneous prayer, given thanks for the particulars of the day and the people around the table. And, you know, I think that's one of the nicer traditions that we could bring back, and I think a lot of families do. I think there are a lot of families where part of their tradition is to go around the table and to think of people who are no longer there at Thanksgiving, but also to say, you know, what we're thankful for. And it, in a lot of ways, you know, even our Thanksgiving table in my family, you honor the past by remembering the dishes you have on the table that were, you know, on grandma's table. As you mentioned, there were, you know, there's a dish or two that you have that were traditional. And so I think Thanksgiving can be a way of honoring the past of your family as well as looking to what you're thankful for in the present.
And we have a lot to be thankful for, don't we?
Absolutely.
Thanks to Kathleen Curtin for contributing to the program. For KNIA KRLS News, this is Dr. Bob Leonard bringing you today's news and information in depth from our little corner of the universe.
An audio copy of today's in-depth program is available at KNIAKRLS.com on demand or for download. If you have topics or show ideas you'd like to hear in-depth, contact KNIA KRLS by sending an email to BobLeonard@KNIAKRLS.com. The one to count on for today's local news and the number one news and information source in Marion County is KNIA KRLS.